In the black community, black women are outpacing black men.
True.
They have stepped up, they're getting education, they're probably number one in starting businesses, so they are ready to get married. And what is going on with the men?
In today's age, nobody wants to put their foot out. It's like, if you're not putting your own house, I'm not putting it out there.
You don't want to be a mumu.
I don't want to be a mumu. And I think your willingness to be a mumu first is what then might look like masculine energy, because it's less about what you have in your bank account. It's really more about saying,
even Anwar, right, is a gay black man. Why can't you use your voice to speak to men?
Our grandfathers never saw this level of temptation. Like, maybe at bare minimum, they knew the finest girl in their village.
So you sent me a clip this week from Ryan from the Pivot podcast,
yeah.
Right? And he was
Ryan Clark.
Okay. And he was talking about how men used to pursue women, right? And this was even before social media. There was like almost an art to it. So tell me, why did you send me the video? What did you think you want me to see?
Yeah, I think we were at Jude's place and we're just talking about some of the struggles we've had with Legacy, which is our dating platform, catering to high achieving singles in the diaspora, and how you're just seeing the dynamics that have changed in terms of relationships, dating, how men approach women, how women approach men, and just realizing that for a vast majority of, like, quote unquote, the high value, high functioning men, that's what these women are looking to date. The men truly believes today that they're the bad bitches. Like, they're the ones that should be approached, right? And I think for a lot of the women, they've not really realized how a lot has changed in these times. And what we're talking about was, prior to like cell phones or prior to social media, a lot of men are actually beta men.
Mm.
And that it was the alpha men in the group who would push you to say, hey, go get her number, go get her this, or go talk to her. And even if you get rejected, keep your reps up. So go talk. Even if you get rejected, it's okay. Rejection is part of the game. But all they can say is no, right? And so what happens now is, in the age of social media and dating apps and your ability to hide behind a DM, men are now, they don't have to deal with that rejection. And then a lot of the men are now saying to themselves, like, look, you know, you see, we can't even approach them because they might say it's harassment, or it's like or they're getting harassed, and, you know, we don't want to get canceled. I'm like, well, we've lost something in that art, right? So again, there might have been a slight miscorrection. And I think I want to even speak more to this, because I do think the Me Too movement was something that was very needed, but there has been, in my opinion, an overcorrection, right? Where we have now let certain things suffer because of that. Men don't feel like they should approach women, but some women do want to be approached. Men don't feel like they should marry anymore. They're quiet quitting the whole process of dating. And I don't think a lot of women are realizing, like, this overcorrection has led to some of these men, some of them, not all of them, being pushed into the arms of people like Kevin Samuels,
Andrew Tate.
And I'm not saying that it's the responsibility of the women, but it's just to say there was an overcorrection, right? And I think there has to be a space where we can have this conversation and say, hey, respect women, honor women's bodily autonomy. But at the same time, if there is a way in which you can show up in your biological sense as a man, approach a woman with respect and talk. But now you're having a situation where women, we were all taught, go to school, get a job, get married. And a lot of the women seem to have held up their own end of the bargain, but they're looking out and seeing there are no men for them to marry at the end of it. And I'm sure some of them are asking, like, what's going on? Why don't these men approach anymore? Why don't they do this? There's a lot of compounding things that have happened, whether it's from the Me Too movement or from the beta men now feeling relaxed and saying, hey, there are no more alpha men now to push me, because I can go tell the alpha men, like, well, we're in an environment now where you can get canceled. So it doesn't make any sense to go ask for the number if I can get canceled. And even we were talking about how some men don't even ask for numbers anymore. They'll ask for your IG. They'll ask you for your Instagram handle, your Snapchat handle, because it's the happy medium between rejection and no rejection. Most people will give their social media out for free, right? But if it's a number, it's still much more personal, right? So they don't want to get the rejection of the number not being given. So they were like, let me get your Instagram handle.
Yeah, but so this is my thing, right? Mm. My challenge here, we're going to debate about this,
yeah,
right? Is that I believe women have done the work.
Yeah.
Right? So, and I can only speak to black women because that is the community I speak to every day. Even though I think this is an issue across the board, across all races, that women are now becoming more educated. But the truth is, in the black community, black women are outpacing black men.
True.
Right? They have stepped up. They're getting education. They're getting their masters. They're probably number one in starting businesses. They're going to therapy. They're getting coaching. So they are ready to get married, right? And what is going on with the men? Because my issue is, and I like this drives me insane, how all the coaches I'm seeing for dating is pandering to women.
Yeah.
So even Anwar, right, is a gay black man. I have no problem because he gives good advice, but I'm like, why is another man? Why can't you use your voice to speak to men?
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Kevin Samuels literally profited off of talking to black women.
Yeah.
Derek Jackson also, like, I can't, even the Steven Speaks guy, he's the number one dating relationship guy. He never really talks to men.
Yeah.
And he himself is single.
Yeah.
So I'm like, you're single and you're talking about every day, I'm helping people get married. So I'm really just like, I think my biggest challenge here is, and I speak this a lot of times to your friends, and I talk a lot to different guys, and I'm like, what is going on with the men? Like, yeah. Why are y'all not stepping up? Sure, feminism has happened, right? And I have critiques around how I think it has, like you said, overcorrected and made some women anti-men. It's made women a little bit militant versus men. So I understand all that. But my other challenge is, why are black men not stepping up? They know there's some issues, there's some drama, there's some trauma they need to deal with. Why are they not doing the work to get ready?
It takes courage, right? And I think, but what also happens is in society today, as a man or even as a black man, you can show up dysfunctional as a black man and still be celebrated. You can be high value, but not high functioning, right? So what happens is most or a lot of black men can show up with money or status or be successful, quote unquote, and not actually have to do the inner work and still be seen as a worthy catch or a worthy partner. So for a lot of men, even along their friendship circles, they might not even have accountability with that, because as long as you show up and like, hey, you went to the school, you have the job, you have a little bit of money, who gonna check you? It's the same thing that happened with Diddy. Like, who's going to check you? Like, you have marked all the things that signify success in society, right? So the inner work that requires you to then go for the therapy, sometimes a lot of that push has to either come from your internal self or for friends who truly deeply care about you, who can push you and say, hey, I think you need to go do therapy. I think you need to go unlearn some of these behaviors. Because even when we watched the whole Cam Newton interview, he's a successful man. He went, he played football. He's earned $100 million. But he's saying to himself, like, on every metric that's being measured for what high value looks like, I pass. But the question then was, is it only high value we're optimizing for? Is it high functioning as well? So I do truly believe that when more men start to filter in for the high functioning part, they'll realize that there's still much more work to be done. Nobody is ever perfect, but it's to really get on that path to healing, self-awareness, being able to unlearn some of the toxic behaviors as well, while still showing up as a man. And like, what does it mean to show up as a modern man in today's age as well, right? And I think emotional intelligence is a must. Like, you cannot be showing up and not have emotional intelligence as a man today.
So that's a nice little package that you just said, but most men are not there.
No, they're not there, but I feel like
most men are not really trying to do the work. And Cam Newton, he went on to this, you know, many podcasts, and he's still spewing what he's spewing. Because I also think there's a lot of women that will marry a Cam Newton, or not even marry, they'll give themselves to him. Yeah. I mean, he's had multiple children, meaning there's women willing to accept his lifestyle. Nick Cannon, I mean, the list goes on around a lot of women, even in Nigeria, right? There's lots of men that have multiple women, right? Baby mamas, whatever. So I also feel like, okay, what is actually going to be the push? Like, do we have to get extreme, like Japan, where the women have said, I'm closing my legs, and now they're having birth issues because nobody wants to have children anymore?
It's not going that far. Things are tight in the country.
No, I mean, it may have to.
Things are tight in the country. You don't need to go that far. I do honestly think that podcasts like this and much more men-centered spaces where men are held accountable, even with like legacy, right? We've done a good job of creating a legacy men channel where men come in there and they're talking through some of their issues and we basically pour into each other and give each other quality advice. We need more of those men spaces that speak to what's the depth of these issues, because too many men spaces are too surface level, right? Like, let's talk about women, let's talk about money, let's talk about sports, right? And it's not to say those things are not great, but at some point you have to have a space that actually goes into talking through some of these inner, deeper level conversations. And I think the thing with men is men need to feel psychologically safe to open up about some of these issues, right? Like, I think society by and large, caters to women being more emotional, caters to women just even being expressive about their emotions. But for a lot of men, they're dealing with two things. They're dealing with the perception of other men. They're also dealing with the perception of women as well. So they're saying sometimes the best thing is to just bottle things in and not talk, right? So I think getting to the point where understanding that oversharing is not vulnerability, but vulnerability is also not weakness, right? So being able to find the happy medium between the two.
And you talked a lot about what you learned as far as building legacy, building this dating app for Black men and women. What are you learning about the women? Because I have some thoughts, right? But yeah. I'm curious, as a man, you know, looking in, what are you seeing that you're like, this thing needs to, there's something, a challenge here?
Yeah, I think for me, I always assumed, and things have changed because of the social media era, but I always assumed that both men and women went to some sort of etiquette classes or rite of passage classes.
Wait, why did you assume that?
Well, because we had one when I was coming up.
Yeah, we went to, like,
they literally teach you how to use a fork, a spoon, like how to do a bunch of these things, right? And it wasn't necessarily etiquette just even for that. And I know women who also went through that as well. But that, like, there was a, okay, how do you do makeup as a woman? How do you make sure, like, your legs are shaved? Or, you know what I mean? Like, those type of women care things. And then for a man, how do you make sure the things you need to do, whether it's a rite of passage or I went to boarding school. So in boarding school, you're seeing other older guys tell you, like, okay, cool, this is how you do, because they know this or they know that. And I remember, you know, one of the things I feel like has become a lost art is the whole idea of seduction in society when it comes to romantic relationships. Like, I don't, that I'm not saying seduction on some heavy porn type level, but just really like small things as like a white handkerchief, right? And I remember having to explain to that to ladies who came to our legacy event in Houston, where they were saying, look, a lot of these men are not approaching. I don't know what to do. I don't want to be the one who goes up to them to tell them to start asking, because that's not what a woman is supposed to do. The man is supposed to do that. And I'm like, yes, you are right. But there is a world in which you can let a man know that it's safe to approach, especially because we're dealing in an environment now where they don't want to feel like they're harassing you, right? Again, going back to what I was saying, a lot of men are beta. So what is the happy medium where you can do a white handkerchief? And the handkerchief method back in the day was for a way for men to know that, hey, it was okay to approach, or that it was okay for them to approach with their advances, right? So what does that look like? It could be a wink. It could be a smile. It could be a head nod if you're a real Nick.
A head nod?
Yeah, I'm just saying. There's some New York girls who be like, hey, yo, what's good? No, but it's like, you know, being able to, like, just seduction and sensuality and just being able to bring your feminine essence to the table.
So women are not feminine.
Maybe some masculine niggas out here, man. I feel like definitely femininity has gotten a bad rap, but I do honestly feel like going back into that bag, that biological bag, because you can't be a smart woman, a career woman, a woman who's getting it out there, and you can do both. I feel like people should be holistically multifaceted, right? And I think that gives, it makes it even interesting for the men, because they know you have range, at least the men who appreciate range in a person, right? So I think it's really sitting down and really doing the work of, what does it mean to be a wife? What does it mean to be a woman? What does it mean to be a feminine woman? And why does feminine energy matter to men, right? And I think for a lot of times it gets misconstrued, because a lot of women will hear a man say, oh, I want a woman who reminds me of my mom. And then they're like, oh, you just want a woman who's going to cook for you. You just want a woman who's going to be in the kitchen. No, sometimes a man's first introduction to feminine energy is through his mom, right? So when he's speaking to that essence, he's saying, I want a woman who has that same sort of essence that my mom used to have, right? And it's more of the feminine energy, but men don't know how to articulate themselves pretty well, and that they don't have the language for it. And so what ends up happening sometimes is they put their foot in their mouth, and before they know it, they're getting dragged on Twitter, they're getting dragged everywhere else. And so what men then tend to do is just shut down. So what's very dangerous to what I've noticed is a lot of the men have quiet quit the dating process, or the fact that they don't want to get married. A lot of women don't realize that. So they're saying, why aren't they approaching? The men have quite quit. They've looked for other things to do. They're like, I'm not pressed anymore. You know, and I feel like it's something where we have to get back to the point where we realize, as both men and women, that we do need each other, right? Hold each other accountable, help each other in paths to heal, but that there has to be a recognition that men and women need each other, and this is why we need each other, and then put value in that.
Yeah, but I want to talk about something you mentioned earlier, which is we have a lot of beta men, right? So number one, you agree that more men are beta these days.
Majority of men are beta, even before these days. Like, that's what it's always been. Yeah.
Okay. So I have a point here. So I think, and it's kind of like a chicken before the egg situation, right? Where I agree with the whole etiquette and a woman learning how to be feminine, right? Because the biggest debate I had on Twitter about this was basically me and a woman were going back and forth about femininity, right? And her assumption was, well, I'm a woman, I'm feminine. And I said, no, you're not. Because a man could be feminine too. You don't understand it's that. So sides, it's both sides. It's an energy. It's not a gender, right? And so my point to her was that, yes, the issue is because women are being forced to work and, you know, we are making the decisions, we're more logical, we're taking on all this masculine roles. Therefore, a lot more women are more in their masculinity, right? And so that was what I was trying to explain. So there are women that are going around saying, I am a feminine woman because I'm a woman. And they don't understand they may be masculine, right? Yeah. I think it's just now that women are starting to understand, like, oh, this is an art that is lost, right? But I also say, and this is why I say it's chicken before the egg. So the other side of it is I also feel masculine men help women feel feminine.
Yeah.
Right? And so, like, when you said we were dating, right, I felt like I could be feminine around you, right? My mom taught me how to be feminine. My mom's a very feminine woman. I feel like I learned a lot from that. But I also think you created a space for me to feel like I could be feminine, feel soft, feel like a princess, right? And that's why you also got the energy. I feel like a lot of men are not making women feel safe.
Yeah.
They're not making this, they're not giving an environment of, you know, I'm a masculine man. And to be honest, I'm tired of fighting with dudes about being a provider and provider mindset and what that looks like. I'm not gonna name his name. I was debating with your friends the other day. And his thing was like, oh, well, black women, they just want to go on vacations and they just want to go around the world. They want luxury. And I'm like, who told you that?
Yeah.
I just want a man who thinks, you know, the conversation we were having earlier, big about, like, I just want a normal dude.
Yeah.
A normal dude that says, hey, I will take you to dinner. I will pay for the date. I will court you. I think that art is lost.
No, you're right. And it got lost to the same way we were talking about the art of seduction with women. I think the rite of passage where men or older men taught other men how to move also got lost in that thing. And I think a lot of it put on the men and the women's side. If we really want to be honest, we have substituted that guidance to social media. So, and a lot of those voices on social media are unhealed voices. So the women are hearing from unhealed voices. The men are also hearing from unhealed voices, and then they internalize it, right? So in that particular scenario where men are like, oh, women just want providers and they want men who will use. It's like, no, how I was raised was, look, you can show up and provide for a woman. And if you don't necessarily have it, maybe you go work on yourself for now, right? But the most important part too is how do you communicate and lead in that communication? So I remember when I first met you, I literally said to you, Auntie, this is how much I have in my bank account. So because it was better that I was honest with you from the beginning. So it would then let me know how you were moving. So if you know how much...
React?
You're like,
I took it like a G.
He took it like a G. And I was like, but to me, it was a way for me to remove the anxiety. Because again, what happens is a lot of men, we have a lot of self-talk, right? And we will never articulate it out to a woman. And then we will internalize it. And before, when communication breaks down, it just breaks down because they're like, look, it's not even worth talking about, right? But I remember just having to say to myself, like, this woman is important to me. I don't want to lose her by overthinking something. Just be honest and then let the chips fall where they may. If I had shown you the bank account and you were like, the next day, I need you to buy me a bag that costs everything in your bank account, I'd be like, we're not aligned. So it's okay for you to move on, right? And then it lets you know where you sit with the person. But because I was able to first, and I think maybe that's really what leading in that moment looks like, is can you lead in vulnerability? Like, can you be the first person to say, I don't know what this person's response is going to be. I don't know. But let me put my foot out and hopefully they meet me halfway. But what happens is, in today's age, nobody wants to put their foot out. It's like, if you're not putting your own house, I'm not putting it out there.
You don't
there.
Want to be a
moo-moo. I don't want to be a moo-moo. And I think your willingness to be a moo-moo first is what then might look like masculine energy. Because it's less about what you have in your bank account. It's really more about saying, I am leading with my heart open. I know that it's possible for my heart to be broken, but it's better to live with a hurting heart than to live with a closed one, right? And so I think a lot of the men have lost that sort of guidance where it's like, look, it's okay. You don't always, and I think for a lot of men now, they think if I have money, then I'm gallant. I can show up. And it's like, not necessarily, because there might come a time when you don't have money. So is your identity tied to the money, or are you a person who's capable and has the capacity to love and be loved without money being in the picture, right? Does money make things also good? Great. But you have to also know who you are without that existing as well. And I think for a lot of the men, it's really that lack of guidance. And what I say to some of the men sometimes, because they'll come and say to me these same things, I'm like, the person who's saying this to you, was it the woman, physical woman in front of you that said this to you? Or was this a voice you heard over the internet that you have internalized, that you now keep repeating to yourself? Because the actual women you're dating or seeing or saying to you, I just want a normal guy. Somebody who will say, bless you when I sneeze. Somebody that might open a car door too. And then, you know, nothing too crazy. And so and what happens too is a lot of the men, because of social media, have an idea of a woman they want in their head, which is a bad B. And that lifestyle is a different lifestyle. So you can't be trying to get a bad B and then you want her to have non-bad B tendencies. It doesn't work that way. You feel me? It's trade-offs in life. You feel me? So you have to know which one you want. You have to know which one you want. So I tell them all the time, it's like, really, I think it's leadership and leading even in vulnerability that might help.
And speaking of social media, because I know this was the argument we had, right? I feel social media makes it difficult for people to even build meaningful relationships, because I don't know what's going on in Zuckerberg's internet.
The algorithms.
That algorithm is actually wild. Like, even the other day, one of my burner accounts, we all have one, is I saw like just like almost like naked women like consistently. And I'm like, I know I'm not interacting with this content. I don't know why it's like on my feed every single time, but I'm like, do you think social media has made it difficult? Because I also feel like, and this was a conversation I had with some of the women in Legacy, right? Which is like, I remember one woman was like, oh, you only showed me 2 matches. I need 9. And I was like, no, you need to first assess the 2, like probably look at them, have a conversation, connect with them. If it doesn't work, we'll give you 2 more.
Yeah.
Not all at once. Because I think with Hinge and Bumble and options, even Instagram, there's actually an overwhelming amount of options. Mm-hmm. And I also feel like to a lot of men, I think a lot of men also are like, oh, well, there's lots of options. There's so many women out here. Like, it could be you today, it could be you tomorrow. Like, do you feel like there's a breakdown?
There's an illusion too, right? Yeah. I feel like when I was single, I had the same sort of view, right? It's options. But then when you really look at it, it's really not options. It's something to make you feel comfortable and maybe feel safe in the fact that, oh, there might be somebody out there who's liked your picture or has liked your profile on Hinge or Tinder or whatever. But those options are also an illusion, right? So I think that's where the maturity comes in, where you have to have emotional maturity and be very clear as to what's important to you as a man in life. For a lot of the, honestly, social media has just done so much damage. I know it's been great for great things as well, but the psychological damage it has done to society, I'm telling you, the studies have not even gone far enough, because whether it's how you evaluate meaningful relationships, how you evaluate even the celebrating the joys of other people, where the comparison becomes a thief of joy, right? You literally have to make a concerted effort to protect your mind and maybe take some breaks off, right? Because it's done a lot of damage. And I don't know if we will definitely be able to recover, but we have to be intentional. And probably more conversations like this will help set people on that road to intentionality. But for a lot of it is, the men feel like they have options, the women feel like they have options, but then you're both still single, and then you still feel like there's a void that you need to fill, right? And I think it's realizing that there is such a thing as freedom through commitment. I remember one of the books I read was The Subtle Art of Not Giving a Fuck by Mark Martin. And he was talking about how, you know, there's the generations today celebrate the breadth of experience versus the depth of experience, right? And I remember that being a framework I applied even when meeting you, was I knew what it felt like to maybe be with like 8 women in 1 year, right? No offense, but you know, guys used to be out here. But did I know what it felt like? Did I know what it felt like to be with 1 woman within 8 years, yeah. right? So that's breadth is maybe you've been with 8 women in 1 year. Depth is you've been with one woman for 8 years. And what does that look like? And I think in the generation today, people are chasing breadth because it's such easy to post and say, hey, this is what this looks like. But depth is where the gold really is. But depth is compounding over time. And you might not be able to get to that gold unless you stick in the depth of it, right? And I think that's just the framework. There are books that I recommend to a lot of men to read, like The Way of the Superior Man. Yeah. Obviously, Naval's book is one I keep on reading. But you really need to read books that remind you of who you are. And speak to, like, obviously the Bible. The Bible is definitely one that I'm recognizing more and more. Oh my God. Quotables in that book. Quotables. But you have to read books that really remind you of who you are and the values that you actually want to stick to. Because social media, those algorithms are pretty powerful, right? And we used to joke in a lot of my men's groups, like, our grandfathers never saw this level of temptation. Like, maybe at bare minimum, they knew the finest girl in their village or the finest girl in their town. To be able to open up a device and you're seeing the finest babes across the world and they're only a flight away, bruh, it's a different type of temptation.
Yeah, but how do we, like, get more men to do that therapy and that coaching? Because I know, like, with our story, right, I saw some things early on.
Don't go on over share. We're just doing podcasts. Relax. Relax, please.
I won't go into details, yeah. right? That's another episode, right? But I remember saying to you, you need to go to therapy, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. Because I knew there was potential, right? And I knew that there was something great in you, but therapy, you know, I didn't know what needed to be unlocked, mm-hmm. but I knew that you needed to go through that process, yeah. right? And that's where you're here today, being mm-hmm. able to talk through all these different dynamics.
Yeah, therapy helps.
But therapy helps. Feel like I talk to a lot of dudes and they don't want to do therapy. They don't want to do the work. And it's almost this like victim mentality of, you know, like, woe is me and I'm a black man in America yeah. or Nigeria, wherever, and nobody's looking at me. You know, and that is the truth. I do think a lot of men have been largely ignored for quite some time because we've been trying to do so much for women and trying to bring women up to this equality standard. And it's almost like we went like this, like yeah. we pass and now women are, you know, we're moving and we're still fighting because there's still things that, you know, women need. But I just think a lot of men have been ignored and I don't know how we're going to change that or how we're going to get more men to get the help they need.
Yeah, but it's also on men to do the work for the other men, right? Mm-hmm. I don't think it's necessarily for women to come help men figure that out, which is why I said, I think one of the things I'm hoping conversations like this will help do is start to usher in these conversations. I know my guy, Naz, he literally has a men's wellness mixer where it's only men that show up, right? So if you can start to have more spaces for men to show up, get peer-to-peer mentorship, get peer-to-peer or even elder to young in mentorship, unk to OG or OG to unk mentorship as well, you know, like it's very, very needed and we need to create those spaces for us, right? And I don't think it's something that the women have to take responsibility for. We're the ones who've benefited most from the setup of the system, right? So it's on us to then go back and say, how do we now set up systems that actually teach us what it is to actually be a man? I know now that, you know, I'm married and I'm like much more as an adult, I seek out older men, right? Mm-hmm. For advice, for mentorship, for coaching, right? Where it's like, look, I need guidance and there's no arrogance about that. Like being able to say like, look, I really do need some sort of guidance. How am I supposed to live? And especially because now you can look at some of the men you want to emulate if they're 60 or 65 and like I'm 34 now. I'm saying, okay, I want to at least be close to how you're living when I'm your age. What are the type of things you've done to maintain up until that point? And for the vast number of them, they speak to getting married was very important. Obviously you have kids, but you have the right sort of values and that compounds over time. Right. And so, yeah, I feel like that's the work that needs to happen.
Yeah. And I think lastly, I want to talk about, you know, in today's conversation, we talked about power, influence, control, legacy. I mean, where do you think the future of all of this is?
Man, I feel like when the year first started, we went to my uncle's funeral. Right. And I think one of the sermons was, what shall it profit a man to gain the whole world but lose his soul? I remember just being, that was such a I'd heard that passage before, but this time I had a lot to reflect on it with.
It hit different.
I remember just thinking about it and just saying, even as a society or as Black people or as Africans or as Nigerians specifically, we have somewhat lost our way where the values are not there as much. And we've tended to then celebrate wealth, or let's say this person has this money or has this car to represent some sort of meaning. And we see the movie play out across the board. Like, you see somebody gets built up, there's a crash. Somebody gets built up and then there's a crash. And I think for a lot of people, by the time they have, I think my coach was saying to me, like, what is the most expensive life purchase, Halik? And he was saying, it's a midlife crisis, right? And what a midlife crisis sometimes signifies is you've been living life thinking it was this way, and then you wake up realizing that the ladder to that success was placed in the wrong place. Mm. And so then now you have to climb down, get that ladder again, and go place it somewhere else. And most people are not willing to do that because they're used to what is looks good on paper. Like, people know me for this. I've been known for this. Do I want to do the work of really coming back and telling people, like, oh, it's not as banging as you thought it was over this side. Let me move over here. And I remember just thinking through, life will always give you exit ways to pivot. A lot of people don't like to take those exits, right? They're like, yo, we're going to keep going until we hit the crash out. And then that's where your midlife crisis starts to happen. So for me, I feel like the lesson I really learned is do the therapy, because the therapy will help you know, like, look, is this an exit I have to take? I know with my therapist, like, just her just being able to say to me, like, hey, are you ready for a change? Is this time to upgrade from this OS 1 to OS 2 or OS 3? And are you willing to have the courage to make this pivot, even if you're used to the status that comes and the status and the praise that comes with being this other person? But if that other person no longer serves you, are you willing to pivot? And that's where I think, like, living in that wisdom, the wisdom is going to be very important, right? Wisdom, relationship, I'm sure, with God, with the Bible, read the books, do the work, and just understand that you're optimizing for a life. I think one of my favorite quotes was when somebody said, you're not just seeking generational wealth, you want generational freedom for your people too, right? So what does that look like to optimize for over time?
Yeah, I want to pull on this thread because, so literally my threads, right, have been going viral because I've been talking a lot about specifically being in your 30s and going through life's pivots, right? And, you know, one that I just posted the other day was talking about the grief. Right? The grief of, I had a certain life. I thought I was going to live a certain way. And I realized I can't live that way for whatever reason. You know, something happened. Maybe I got fired. Maybe I got laid off. Maybe I hate my job. Maybe a friendship. I mean, there's so many different layers to it. And you making that decision that you have to pivot. But sometimes you're sad for, you know, the life that you lost. And I think when I think about all the messages I get from people, a lot of times it's like almost like I don't know how to get up, right? I feel stuck. I feel like I don't know how to navigate my way. You know, when I think about the funeral we went to, I wonder if that was kind of what it was like, I had everything. I thought my life was going to be a certain way. And then now it's very different and I don't know how to get up. Yeah. And some people decide, you know, I want more for myself. And some people realize that their story has not been finished yet. And there's another chapter and I now I'm ready to write that chapter. And some people the book ends, you know? So I wonder, like, what is the word we can leave people today? Just understanding, like, I want to get up, especially for people that are watching this, because I know a lot of people, those threads, they go viral every single day. And I really think it's because a lot of people feel stuck.
Yeah. I think honestly, the way how I approach things now is the frameworks, right? If it's career, if it's relationships, it's really compounding. Like, people, I remember when I was coming up, they would always say Warren Buffett, like, the way he made money was compounding, compounding, compounding. I'm like, which one is compounding? Like, but now as I'm older and I'm 34 now, I now have at least 15 years of my life to look back on to, like, when I was 15 and realize, like, oh, certain decisions you made then, whether it's in terms of health or career or even academics, have compounded over time to make you who you are today. And that this applies across the world. You have to compound in relationships. You have to compound in friendships. You have to compound even in business, right? And so I think the only thing I can say to people is that as long as you draw breath in this life, you can always reinvent. Like, your story is not over because somebody says, oh, you used to be in this person. It really is up to you to get up, reinvent yourself, and then keep it pushing. And there's always, I know some people are always like, yo, does everyone deserve a second chance? I believe everyone does. It just means that you have to, whatever redemption arc that you have to take, you have to be authentic and sincere in it and then walk that path, because the human experience is filled of people who always had a second chance. Like, even I remember the other day we were talking about Paul in the Bible with Damascus. He went from being the chief person who hunted Christians to being the ultimate Christian person himself. So he woke up and decided to choose different. And I'm not trying to necessarily make it religious, but reinvention is there as long as you're able to go through. And the most important part for me is just surrounding yourself with people who can hold you accountable. I feel like too many people surround themselves with yes people or sycophants or people who don't even have the courage to hold you accountable. Seek out people who will tell you the truth as it is and not necessarily hold back from it because they want the best for you, you know? And then, you know, it should work out from there.
Recently, there has been some drama in the Herbert Wigwe estate. And just to give a little bit more context, Herbert Wigwe was a CEO of Access Bank, one of the top banks in Nigeria. And they have many branches all over the world globally. And last year, unfortunately, his helicopter going to, I believe it was a Super Bowl, right? Yeah. With his wife, his first son, as well as there were some other members as well, all died tragically on a plane crash last year. And so now there seems to be this struggle between certain family members of his estate. And Eche, you always talk about how power is not about just money, right? It's about control. So what do you think is happening right now?
I think it's the same story you've seen with so many Nigerian families, right? Like, this is Herbert's estate's struggles or fighting is not the first one. It's very hard to find one Nigerian family that has passed down wealth in a way that doesn't come with infighting or just being able to keep multi-generational wealth. And it's a problem that we seem to have, not just in Nigeria, but across Africa, even with Black people in general, right? So I think part of it is, how do we get to the point where, as we're passing down wealth, how does this actually lead to in multi-generational wealth, right? And I think one of the things I've been reflecting on is where I think we miss the boat a lot is we only focus on passing down the wealth, but not the values that build the wealth, right? So if we can get to the point where there's so many times where, to be honest, some family members you might have might be waste men or waste women. And you know this, so you'd be like, look, in my will, just put this one on the side. But when you really go back to interrogate, like, at what point was there a divergence in this sibling situation or in this family, right? And I think as a man, when you're thinking through your legacy, part of your legacy is, I think it's Naval, I always say this quote to you where he says, you want to fix the world, but your family is broken, right? And so you have to also dedicate time to thinking through, how do we bring our families or my family together? And sometimes it might not be possible to repair. And then obviously that's where Herbert then made plans for his partner Ike to be a trustee on his estate. But it's just sad because you say to yourself, like, with all this wealth, we still couldn't even be a family. So what's the trade-off? And is this trade-off even worth it? You
know? Yeah, and I want to go deeper into this because what's interesting about this specific scenario, which I think a lot of Nigerian families miss, is that a lot of times there's no plan. There's no will put in state. And a lot of times they don't think about, okay, if someone in my family can't actually do the right thing, let me pass it on to someone I trust, which is what he did, right? He made sure his trust was actually insured with Ike because he knew he was going to be able to take care of his children if something was to happen to him. So why do you think this fight is still happening, or what do you think is actually going to be the solution?
Probably some of the things he feared is probably what is coming to pass, which is, hey, if I know that my family might move mad, or do I fully trust that my family will have the best interest of my children if something was to happen to me? You know what? Let me hedge my bets and make sure that, like, someone like an Ike or somebody who's closer to me than even a brother at this point might be able to step in. I think it's just sad because we've seen the same thing play out in our families, right? I think even this past January, we were literally reflecting when you say to yourself, like, why do so many prominent Igbo families or even Nigerian families are incapable of passing these things down? And why does wealth that's supposed to bring people together end up being the thing that makes a lot of folks fight between each other. And sometimes, like, if Herbert was to come back today and hear about what was happening, he would be so heartbroken, right? Because you gather a lot of this wealth because you believe that it will bring your family together, it will bring joy into your society or bring joy among your friends and family, but sometimes it ends up tearing people apart.
Yeah, and I wonder, because I'm thinking how I would feel, right, that Wigwe's daughter, right, is caught in the crosshairs of all of this, and I'm wondering, how does she feel that literally what it appears is like they set it up where the grandpa is now fighting over the wealth. How do you think she would feel in like all of this?
I think obviously there could be a little bit of confusion.
Yeah.
Right. But I think she will grow up fast. I think if she's her father's daughter, I'm sure he passed on some wisdom to her. Trust me, she's definitely not the first. She will not be the last. But I think there is a way in which these cycles do have to end. It doesn't make any sense. Like even when your dad was with us the other day, we were just talking about so many Nigerian families that this has happened to, where they end up in court after the person has passed. And you're saying, even when there's a will, there's a fight. Even when there's no will, there's a fight. So I think Warren Buffett was the one I was telling you what he said with his latest letter, where he says, you know what? What he's going to do is, in his will, he's called all the people in his will and read out the will to them in real time, so that if you have any issues with anything he's saying in his will, you can give feedback there. And if he considers your feedback pretty well, he can incorporate that feedback. Because he was saying that what people tend to do with wills is, okay, this is read after the fact. But then after the fact, this is where the fights come. Even when you even do a video to say, these are my wishes, they can say, oh, but you changed your mind right before you died. So these are where all the issues are coming from. So he said, and I actually admired what he said. He said, call the people together, sit them down, read your will in front of them. If there are any issues, let it be discussed there and then, right? And then if you feel like they've made good points, you can rectify some parts of the will, but then nobody can now say that this were not your wishes because you said it to them. And then you can now transition at the time you need to transition.
Yeah. And I want to even, you know, because this is probably one of the biggest fights I have with my dad. Right. So I'm curious, like, why do you think wealthy African families don't want to plan estates, don't have stronger estates? Are they afraid to plan for death? Because I'll say for me, right. So when I spoke to my dad, because my dad has assets in different places, you know, he even has land in South Africa. He has a home in Atlanta. And, you know, my dad is in his 70s, right? And I believe my dad will have time, right? He's going to see his grandchildren. Mm-hmm. He has time on this earth, but things happen, yeah. Right? And so I've been saying, Dad, like, let's make sure you actually have everything in place. Yeah. And it's almost like, oh, are you trying to say I'm going to die? Or are you trying to wish me away? What are you trying to say? So I'm like really trying to understand why our families have such an issue with estate planning.
It's an Hollywood movie now. So now that you know that you stand to inherit, next thing you know, cars jam me.
Yes.
So, like, I feel like it's one of those fears where, which is understandable because in this Nigeria, people can be very wicked, right? But I think it's they're trying to balance between, when do I start planning for my passing? Nobody really ever likes to sit down to really think through, hey, I'm going to die one day. What will it look like after I've gone? Most people want to live forever, whether they admit it or not, right? And so, but the most part, I think the fear is really like, look, if somebody knows that they stand to inherit certain things from me, they might feel like, why are you here now? Like, if you go now, I feel the drive range tomorrow. So it's time for you to be packing it up. So I feel like that's the fear that a lot of them have, where it's like, look, if we start talking about this thing in a real way, they might really, what if I also get into some health issue, but I'm willing to fight and I'm willing to fight this issue. But then they're asking you, please, there's an opportunity for you to pull the plug now or let him fight. You'd be like, put the plug on. I have 100 million naira waiting for me if it goes. So I think there's some of these things that, like, play in the back of the head of people, but that's why it's important to approach it, I believe, from a place of courage and say, like, look, when it's my time, it'll be my time. Hopefully nobody can fast forward that time for me, but let's have these discussions, because there's nothing sadder than when it's time to be burying you, people are fighting about your wealth. So it means that sometimes you didn't live a life that led to some sort of clarity, right? If why are we fighting after the fact? Why couldn't we even fight when you were alive, right? So now you also, you can't control everything, right? But you should have at least done something to set the stage where people can live in peace after you're gone, right? It shouldn't be something where your families are in court documents are showing things about your family that should not have been outside. People, strangers are just parsing through your family legacy and for what? Right. When all it would have taken would be sit these people down, tell them what your wishes are, and then let them go live in peace after you're gone.
Yeah, because we were talking about this the other day. And what I was saying is because I think the recent news was, I believe Joyce is Herbert Wigwe's sister's name. Mm-hmm. And she's like doing press conferences. And I'm like, why is she doing a press conference over the fighting or what happened? And to be honest, before this point, I personally, I don't know, you could correct me, that I've never seen her before. Yeah. Like, I've never seen her do any type of interviews. I've never seen her talk. I've never seen, you know, really too many family members speaking anything. So I think it's also now, like, starting to taint his legacy. And he's done so much and built so much. And now it's like, for years, we're just going to be hearing about, you know, the drama of the family.
Yeah, but I also think that that's why he chose Ike, right? Because I think sometimes when people don't have power, they want to use the noise of the media to as leverage. They know Ike is not going to be doing any interview. They know he's not going to send anything that they want to do. And plus, he has power, right? So this whole, they might even be trying to paint the narrative that maybe he wants to keep the money for himself. But thankfully, people know that he has money. So why would he, not to say that people don't want more money, but it's like, what's his incentive, right? So I think it's probably their way of fighting back because they know that, like, it's going to be over Ike's dead body literally before he lets them, like, rubbish Herbert's legacy or even affect his kids. So
yeah, and I think the last thing I want to say here is because I have a friend who is in family offices, right? And so he tells me how some of these very wealthy families in the U.S., like the Rockefeller, it's very intentional, right? Yeah. So literally every summer they have a family meeting, they have conversations, like it's a consistent conversation. So I also think the important part here is that like even though an African becomes wealthy, it does not become generational.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
It doesn't pass on, you know, consistently. And I'm wondering if you've ever seen really good examples of like generational wealth where it's not even, because I think typically what I see in Nigeria is the grandpa did something, right? And then literally it's passed on to the son, yeah, the daughter, yeah, they live a little. By the time it gets to the grandchildren, it's like gone. The money has squandered. It's finished.
It's gone. But I think that's why the whole conversation was sometimes it's better for you to pass down values, and then those values might be the foundation for them to be able to maintain the wealth for future generations. Because if you're passing down wealth and all people know, sometimes you can have so much money that you're actually broke. That's all you have. It's money, right? So we see it so much, and you're like, look, the work that it took to build this is squandered, right? And I think that quote where it says strong men create good times create weak men create hard times, and then hard times create strong men, right? It's a cycle. And I feel like if you go through Nigeria's cycle, or even just a lot of the issues we're facing, you're seeing it, right? Like one person will start off the race, the next generation might squander it, the hard times then come, and then you have to reset. But we have to actually be able to move past those cycles. And I think the most important part is the values that you pass down. That's the stuff that can last through the ends of time.
So speaking of ends of time, right? I personally believe is history written by those who write it, right? So speaking about IBB, he just launched his book, right?
Babangida.
He did a huge book launch. All the who's who was there, right? So do you think he's trying to accurately finally write down what happened during his regime? It was a regime, right?
Yeah.
Or is he trying to curate his reputation?
You know, the thing in Nigeria, growing up here, they didn't teach us this history. I had to learn a lot about Nigerian history after I moved to the U.S. So he's literally at the stage where there are Nigerian kids today that don't know about him, don't even know about that period. So if he writes this book, it can be the last topic on the conversation. So it's possible for you to possibly whitewash your reputation in Nigeria's history because we're still such a young country, right? So he's older than Nigeria is in independence. You know, so for me, I read the whole book. I remember just coming out of it like, I don't feel the authenticity coming out from this book. It feels like, hey, you've given me your life history, how you came to be. But the consequences of the actions that came from your regime, we're still suffering until today. The people who even came after you, you guys are all kicking. Whether I was the Ghana president, whether it's you guys, it's like, yo, Nigerians are suffering, right? Like we went from being a GDP of 3,000 naira per capita to $800 today. That is a devastating look on you guys' legacy. So you're writing the book and you're apologizing for what happened in June 12th that you take full responsibility. But taking full responsibility will be like, why are every Nigerian 100 million naira? That's the full responsibility right there. Take it, go to NIBS, ask for all our account numbers and start wiring. You feel me? That is how we would know that you're taking responsibility. Don't be taking responsibility and saying, oh, because Nigerians are actually suffering. Right. And a lot of these things started in your time period. Now, did he do some good things in his administration? Yes, because as I was reading it, you just start to realize like he was probably one of the longest head of states that stayed. He was there for 8 years. There are some programs that he actually started that were pretty good. But in general, like that decision to annul those elections, he was saying that he had to annul because Abacha had actually gone out, or Abacha was trying to take over. He was also worried about his life. You know, his life could have been at risk. A lot of coups used to happen during that time. So he basically potentially took the cowardly way out and agreed with them. But then you start to say to yourself, like, maybe that's also the issue we've had in this country. Like, there have been too many cowards, but the cowards also tend to live long. That's the other thing, too. Like,
can all
the
courage, speak on that? Who's all the courageous, living long and is a
all,
coward?
All the courageous people, they are dead. They've been dead since. Everyone see, who else? Muritola Mohammed, a bunch of them, gone. Nzogu, gone. All the cowards, they're living to 90, 100, 105. It goes to show you sometimes, but this life, you know, balance, bro. So I think, like, Nigerians' history is just filled with a lot of folks who could have made choices that would have allowed us to thrive. And, you know, sometimes they choose to go the other way and we suffer the consequences of it. Like, we know what to do. And I think what I loved in the book, too, was he referenced the fact that, like, if we were to get our stuff together as a country, we would be one of the biggest bastions of the black man globally. And we all know that. But we still keep on trying to figure out our way to this potential. But now I was saying to him, like, I don't think he realizes that part of his legacy is there are generations and generations of Nigerians who have japa'd. Mm-hmm. Like, there are generations and generations of Nigerians who will not be able to grow old with their mom, their dad, their friends, people that they grew up with, because they had to leave this country for better opportunity and optionality elsewhere. And I think if he was to really sit back and think through the effects of the legacy that they've left, it's terrible. There are people, I remember I watched a video the other day of a guy in Finland who he hadn't seen his mom in 10 years, right? And you're asking, like, okay, what would lead you to not see your mom for 10 years? Obviously, probably he japa'd. Paperwork was probably not as right, and you've gone 10 years without seeing your mom. In those 10 years, your mom could have passed away, right? So there are people who are in foreign countries who might not be able to come back for their dad's funeral, their mom's funeral, and we shouldn't have to live this way, you know? And I think that that's really the legacy that a lot of these people have left, where you have a generation of people who have to flee here for opportunity and optionality.
Yeah, but I think what I'm struggling with is why Africans don't want to hold themselves accountable, right? So, you know, one, I remember this was like a long time ago when I was in foreign policy, and I went to a policy event in Morocco, and every year a lot of dignitaries are there. Obasanjo is there every year and he speaks, and he quietly said that, yeah, I made mistakes, right? But I said, you're now saying this when you're old, you've moved on in life, like, you're not in the current regime. So I wonder, like, why we have such an issue holding each other accountable, or is the power so strong that they're not ready to do the right thing? Because I've seen videos from the 80s about talking about the same issues we're dealing with today. And it just seems like we're in a loop and we don't want to break that loop.
I think from the book, what they would say is there are so many nuances that Nigerians don't realize, that he kept on hinting at the fact that at the time, it was such a tenuous thing to keep Nigeria together. Like, Nigeria, he's like, if you're seeing Nigeria together today and you people are like, oh, Hausa, Yoruba, Igbo, Delta, blah, 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 this wasn't always easy to keep. Like, he was, a lot of the coups that happened, people wanted to actually disintegrate Nigeria. So when you're there and you're trying to balance the trade-offs between hey, do we come out of this as a country as one versus all the other things you guys want us to fix? He's like, look, the most balancing thing that any Nigerian leader can do is come out of that there where the country is still intact. So on one hand, you might say, okay, cool. It's definitely a reality that we are still together in quote unquote, but you're like, we just feel like you could have done more. And that it doesn't take away from the actual corruption that happens, right? Like, let's not act like, oh, we were, you guys were saints and everything was great. There was actual corruption happening, and he doesn't address that in the book. Going back to the whole accountability thing, there wasn't any address in the book of like, okay, was there corruption? What did you do about it? How did you stamp it out? Did you profit from corruption? Because that really is the memoir, because you're about to go now. Tell us, like, how did you chop the life? Let us at least know that. At least see the difference is Hushpuppi chops life. We all see it. We know what he's doing with his life. We say, okay, cool. Even if he's jail now, we know that he chopped it. We saw it. Kulikan, he moved. But you was like, tell us what you did so that at least we know, okay, you have reflected. Maybe there's more money left. You can now send it back to the CBN account and then we can go from there, you know?
Thank you, Eshe. You know, I like these conversations we be having because I feel like we really try to keep it real and authentic here and just have a chance to be able to be vulnerable. And yeah. I'm hoping that these conversations that we're going to continue to have, because we're going to go into all these different types of topics and layers, it's going to allow people to live more authentic lives.
Love it. That's what we're here for, man.